Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
WBEZ is supported by Impact Grants Chicago. Over 400 women come together in a unique model of collective giving. Each member contributes $1,000, and together those donations grow into $100,000 grants for Chicago nonprofits that address critical challenges across the city. By pooling resources, individual gifts multiply into greater impact. Listeners can learn more about Impact Grants Chicago and past grant recipients at impactgrantschicago.org/join2025.
The big news tonight will be Joy Reid's final show on MSNBC. Single tear, white woman tears happening right here, Joy.
It's the end of an era for the online magazine Teen Vogue, as it will no longer operate as its own website.
In addition, several of the magazine's more politically focused writers have been laid off.
Hey, Chicago, it's Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Stick around for a breakdown of the latest local news of the day. But first,
NBC News apparently announced they were eliminating their teams dedicated to covering various DEI issues, the specific channels for Black and Asian American and Latino and LGBTQ groups, laying off about 150 staffers.
I just got laid off from my job at CBS, and every producer on my team who got laid off is a person of color. Every person who gets to stay and will be relocated within the company is a white person.
Black journalists are being laid off from newsrooms at alarming rates. Teams focused on diversity are being gutted at places like CBS and NBC. And entire outlets like Teen Vogue, which leaned pretty heavily into politics this year, have now disappeared. So what happens to news when Black and queer perspectives vanish? How do we make sure they don't? Well, before we get into the conversation, In the Loop producer Sienna Greaves is here with me. Hey, Sienna.
Hey, Sasha. How you doing?
Good to see you. This one is particularly interesting, Sienna. You produced this conversation, and we're looking at each other because, you know, two Black women here in the studio. This is hitting close to home, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
How have you been navigating?
Throughout my career? I mean, as you know, I'm sure is also your experience. I've spent many years in my career in journalism as sort of the lonely only in the newsroom.
That's a good way to put it.
You know, even at a radio station at an HBCU, I was, you know, the lone Black producer.
Oh, my goodness. So, you know, that being said, to your point, yeah, we've seen this happen before. So should we have seen this mass exodus coming? Should we be surprised at all that this is happening,
no,
especially under this administration?
No. We had a good run, guys. We had 5 years, you know, post-George Floyd, the diversity pledges were coming in thick and fast across media, businesses, news orgs. You know, and our guest, Natalie Moore, put this really well when she said that, you know, unless these organizations are really willing to do the work of inclusion, just saying it isn't enough. Mm. Putting a DEI officer in a dark corner of a newsroom is not enough. Yeah. You know, this work, diversity and inclusion, it has to become mainstreamed in your organization. She says it has to become part of the ethos. Otherwise, you're just really putting a Band-Aid on a gaping wound.
Mm. Yeah, very powerful words. You know, the problem is this is a pattern that can't be ignored. And it's a really important conversation that I think we should just get into.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Sienna.
Thank you, Sasha.
At the table was Brandon Pope, president of the National Association of Black Journalists Chicago chapter and host of The Screening Room, a newsletter with TV and film reviews and news. Natalie Moore, who's a Chicago Sun-Times columnist and the director of audio journalism programming at Northwestern University. And Morgan Elise Johnson, who's a filmmaker and co-founder and publisher of The Tribe. So, Brandon, you know, as president of NEBJ Chicago, I know, of course, you are keeping an eye on what's going on nationally. There's been a lot of, our national folks have spoken out quite a bit about this because we're, as I said, seeing this happen basically every month. But I want you to piggyback on what I just described and give us just an overview of what's taking place here.
Yeah, I think what's taking place here overall is you're seeing many things happen. You're seeing a capitulation to an executive branch of government that is exercising a great level of authority over media companies, and through that influencing their decision making, and these media companies feeling like, okay, for me to maintain favor, not have to pay $20, $30 million, I need to follow a DEI edict to remove those who are of color or who are in part of what we call diversity, equity, inclusion programs. You're seeing folks back off the commitments they made in the George Floyd era to, you know, stand up for diverse voices. Mm-hmm. You're seeing a retreat from those promises, and you're seeing, as a result, so many Black voices, Latino voices, and others cut across the country. It feels like every day you probably see the same thing. I scroll on social media.
Yes.
Someone else is saying they got laid off.
LinkedIn has been insane to keep track of.
Yeah, absolutely.
So many announcements of a very similar outcome. Talk about the trickle-down effect that I teased there, Brandon, because mm-hmm. this is not just happening across the country. I want to be clear to our listeners. This is impacting media outlets here in Chicago and Illinois.
You got to think about it in so many ways. I mean, we look at what happened at ABC, with CBS, with NBC. You have a lot of locally owned stations owned and operated by those big national networks. So mm-hmm. when those decisions happen up top, they often have effects here at the bottom. We just had two people laid off at CBS News here locally.
Yeah.
You know, there's been cuts at NBC, and there's fear around the media landscape here, TV-wise and, you know, digital as well, about who's next. Is there going to be another wave happening?
Yeah.
I know people at CBS News nationally right now who they are asking for reassurance. Am I safe? And they're not getting it at all.
They're not getting any answers. So, Natalie, we're not just talking about individual journalists here. We're talking about Black media publications, entire departments, shows that have been eradicated. What is that signaling to you?
That 5 years ago, the George Floyd reckoning was just a fad.
Mm-hmm.
And that these media companies are just like other corporate entities. So it's
You're
important.
Talking about when folks made promises
right.
in 2020 to commit to diversity.
Right. And it's important to not isolate the media, the news media from this or entertainment media, because there were all types of Fortune 500 companies who were emailing Juneteenth messages in 2020.
Oh, I remember that.
Or George Floyd solidarity
Remember
statements.
The black squares?
Yeah.
Yes.
On Instagram?
People started celebrating Juneteenth for the first time. Remember that?
Right.
Yeah.
And so with this, the backlash of this administration, as Brandon mentioned, it's giving people permission and license to do these massive cuts. So when you have race and culture units that are, you know, 5 years old being cut, it just shows that that was lip service and that this isn't work that they really valued, nor was it work that was likely incorporated into those newsrooms.
Right. So with you, Morgan, I want to dig more into the why here, right? Because we have seen the Trump administration's attacks since January, let's just talk about this particular time that he's in office, on DEI, and we're seeing lawsuits. What is driving all these layoffs and firings?
Well, I don't really believe in the term capitulation. I think corporate bosses are doing what they want to do, and they can use this moment as cover to implement the policies that they want to bring forth.
Say more on that.
I am a business owner. So I've been minding my Black-owned business and making decisions that are best for me and my company. But I'm looking around at the media landscape, and I wish we could hire all of the Black people who have been fired. But we also are suffering in this moment because of the cuts in DEI. That means that people who fund journalism are also tightening their wallets, and mm-hmm. they're afraid to fund a publication that says we are a Black-owned publication. So this affects everyone across every industry. And as Donald Trump is Donald Trump is, through this anti-DEI effort, is making it difficult for Black people to just achieve the basic necessities of life, you know, just to be able to live and to work and to feed themselves. It's a way that he's able to cut back on us being able to enjoy the full benefits of being an American citizen here.
What would be the point of that? Why?
Racism, anti-Blackness, white supremacist policy.
Yeah. Public media is not immune to this trend, to your point, Morgan. Earlier this year in February, PBS closed its DEI office and dismissed two employees in charge of DEI work after President Trump issued his executive orders regarding diversity. According to the publication Current, some public media stations, they've been removing or changing online diversity statements amid challenges to DEI programs at the state and federal levels. Natalie Moore, you've got this long career in public media. What do you think? Have you seen it change?
I think you just have to do the work and not worry about the labels or try to hitch your wagon on the term du jour. And, you know, over the years, I've talked to other public radio stations who were looking at starting race units. And these were by people who really believed in it, the reporters and editors. And so how do you do it in a way that is incorporated in your newsroom? You know, there's arguments that maybe don't call it something separate and just embed it in the work.
Right.
Or, you know, I mean,
don't give it a name that gives it away that you're going to be focused on diversity.
Or, you know, even here at WBEZ, before it was the Race, Class, and Communities Desk, it was the community news bureaus. Well, if you're covering Chicago communities, you're going to be covering race issues.
Yes.
So I think that we're in a moment where people are going to have to be, who want to do this work and who are committed, are going to have to be subversive in what they call it. You know, whether it was, you know, it was affirmative action in the 90s, it's DEI today. I mean, that's not a term that we were using really 10, 15 years ago. So I really think ultimately it's about doing the work and what is the commitment of a newsroom to fund that work, to get people to time to do that work, and the support to do that work, regardless of what it's called.
Brandon, this debate about, you know, let's dig into identity and objectivity, right? We've debated, you're chuckling because we've talked about this so many times. Objectivity in journalism has been raging for decades, for centuries. Can we be objective right now in this moment?
I always say you can't stand still on a moving train.
Because folks say that it can't coexist in a newsroom.
It can't. And I also think that when you have attacks on free speech, the First Amendment, the press itself, it is the press's responsibility. We hear people put these platitudes out there. We're you know, looking to stand up for those who are voiceless, you know, be a voice for the voiceless, hold power to account. If you're going to do that, well, when power is raining down and exerting even more authority, trying to eliminate press freedom, which directly impacts our community's ability to receive accurate information, it is our responsibility. It is our noble right to fight back against that as media. So I don't believe in objectivity. I believe we should be fair to everybody in our coverage. But that doesn't mean I got to hold both at equal weight and say, oh, yeah, you know, these attacks on these media companies, maybe there's some merit to it. There's no merit to it at all.
I mean, both sides this.
I can't do it. I can't do it. And when people, I don't think it's possible to be a champion of what press freedom is about and do that. It's not possible.
How are you tackling objectivity at the Tribe, Morgan?
Well, I come from a different storytelling tradition. So as a filmmaker, we were always taught that you're picking up a camera because you have something to say. You are not a neutral observer. And so during your storytelling process, you are making a series of decisions. So you're choosing who's in the frame and who's outside of the frame. Who do I zoom in on, and what do I fade out? So all of those decisions are a type of bias, because what is your eye drawn to? What questions are you asking? Whose voices are you including and whose voices are you excluding? So at the Tribe, we try to be very intentional about those decisions, and we also try to be transparent. Yeah. You know, we have a mission to reshape the narrative of Black Chicago in pursuit of truth and liberation. So yes, we're telling our audience that we are accountable to Black liberation, grassroots movements, and you should read us with that framework in mind. And yeah, we think that that makes our journalism feel more honest, and our audience really trusts us because they know how they should read us and how they should be holding us accountable.
And can I just add, that is not a new perspective. Those who champion press freedom and press access, mm-hmm, those who scream the name of Walter Cronkite and Ida B. Wells, mm-hmm, well, what were those folks doing? They were holding truth to account. They were being very bold in what they were saying.
Right. Ida B. Wells wasn't going out and reporting on lynchings and saying, let me go get the perspective of the white supremacists. You know?
And Walter Cronkite was going out speaking very clearly about the Vietnam War and his opposition to it and yeah, why it was a problem, with facts and details. There's a tradition of this.
Yeah. So then, Natalie, what's the path forward then, you know, for diversity in newsrooms? Is it time for more publications to follow in the steps of, like, The Tribe, for instance, and that mission?
I think that there should be a diversity of types of media outlets. And that's the beautiful thing about demassification and the democratization of news, and also, you know, what the First Amendment is. I also think that we shouldn't shy away from subjectivity. We are all subjective. And in an ideal world, you're bringing those perspectives to a newsroom, but how do you keep them in check? Because we're all biased, and this can be on something small, not something race related, but
right,
you know, I tell students everything doesn't have to have a both side. So to frame this in a different way, I talk about media agenda setting. So the media isn't telling you, or shouldn't be telling you, what to think, but what to think about. And I think people who are coming into journalism, you know, it's hard to not want to be an activist, or, you know, you can't wear that political button. You can't put that sign in the yard. So I like to give the example of the environment.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you're really passionate about the environment. You can be an environmental reporter. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to interview people who are against the science, but it does mean that you'll have to have nuance in your reporting. Let's say there's a big data center that's coming. Getting the different perspectives around it so it's a well-rounded story, but you don't have to go out and quote someone who doesn't believe in climate change. You know, that's the both sidesism. So when you have a passion about something, you yeah, know, storytelling, truth-telling, regardless of the topic or the issue, you can do that work with integrity, and you also don't have to have this very narrow. It has to be objective. It's mm-hmm, about nuance. It's about fairness. It's about balance, not both sides, because most issues don't even have two sides.
Right. No, these are good points. What is our audience losing out on? What are the viewers and the readers and the listeners losing when these programs are canceled and prominent Black voices are just silenced, Brandon?
They're losing perspective. We already in a situation where the media ecosystem is so segmented. The algorithms are designed to only feed you what's going to enrage you or confirm your biases you already have.
Right.
If we don't have that diversity in perspectives coming from these legacy institutions that people are relying on, it's all cookie cutter. It's all the same. And then what's the even point of having these institutions? If people can't be represented, communities that have been harmed for mm-hmm, so long by these, that trust, that mistrust in media, it's only going to grow. And therefore, divisions in this country are only going to grow deeper and deeper. So it's truly an important issue. And I call on many folks to start thinking, and this is what we're doing at NABJ,
yeah,
trying to train folks to think more of an independent journalist mindset and pivot away from relying on the institutions themselves to be the backbone here.
Right. And NABJ is such a beacon of hope, really, for new journalists, right?
You would hope. Well, I think that's the goal. I think NABJ has to change and reframe its mindset now more than ever to directly contradict the media consolidation
mm-hmm,
that is a threat to our voices and start to really think more about how do we not rely so much on the big media institutions of the world and start training people to be freelancers, independent journalists, start their own thing. That's how we build each other up as a community, you know?
This all sends, Morgan, mixed messaging to audience, to the public. All that's happening. They don't know what to trust. They don't know what to do, who to follow anymore. So I feel like public trust in media is eroded because of all of these actions rapidly occurring. But can we recover, you think?
Well, I have to say that, that's a really difficult question because all of the information now is so decentralized. Mm-hmm. And then we're flooded with AI and so much misinformation.
Right.
So now that these trusted voices are being removed from mainstream media, how are people going to find information and the truth tellers that they were usually used to,
right,
to seeing? Everybody's writing on their own Patreon pages, on their LinkedIn pages. How can just information seekers get the information that they need? Hmm. So I know at the Tribe, we're now looking at, how do we grow as a national voice? How do we bring some of these people into the fold as freelancers to just create a new center of Black thought? Because everything is so dispersed. And I'm really concerned about people just being led astray because of AI. You know, Joy Reid has her own show, but there might be an AI version of Joy Reid somewhere,
you being never produced. Know.
It's just really hard to verify sources. Right. And that's the battle that we're fighting now.
And as journalists, we try so hard. We try everything in our power not to be the story. Right, Natalie? This is not what we want to be. But how do you think this spotlight on the industry with these constant headlines of cuts and firings is impacting the work, the bread and butter, what we're actually trying to do here?
I think so much of what's going on in this country is a true distraction to the actual
distraction
work that needs to be done. But I also want to add that media literacy is really important, and that's what we're also talking about. I'm a digital immigrant, but even digital native, you think about really younger people who, if they are getting their news, and this is not a knock on TikTok, organizations, independent or corporate, have to adapt to how people are getting information.
Yeah.
But we all here at least know how to curate. We know what is trusted. We have some media literacy, not just because we're in journalism, but the ages that we grew up in. And so anybody with a camera can give misinformation. And this isn't taking away their right to be on socials.
But it can be very dangerous.
It is.
So how do we, as media organizations, meet the moment?
I think that we have to go where people are. Mm-hmm. I think that
we have to be present as well in those same spaces.
I think hiring younger people, getting younger people to do that audience engagement, because they're more likely to trust them than someone who would be considered ancient.
We trust you, Natalie.
Like me.
We trust you.
Yeah, but maybe on TikTok, they wouldn't.
They'd be like, that's Natalie on TikTok?
I think TikTok.
They wouldn't know who I was. That's my point. The younger people are like, who is this person?
Let's make them know.
Can I just add?
Yeah, final word from you, Morgan.
Yeah, I don't know that we can compete with the Joe Rogans in the same way that they're operating. Mm. For my team, we're a team of 6 people, but we're impactful here in Chicago because I'm like, you got to go outside. People trust us because they know us.
They
and
see
we,
you.
We have a consistent record in the types of stories that we produce. So to break through some of those barriers, some of it just has to be old school human connection.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so also adapting the work. I don't think we should give up what we're doing and say, let's be an influencer or let's start a chat cast.
Yes.
But how do we take the information and distill it in a way, because the mobile devices are how people are consuming.
Right.
WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work blends classroom learning with extensive field education guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open for the early deadline of December 1st at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
All right, now let's get to the biggest local stories of the day. To help me break it all down was In the Loop executive producer Daniel Tucker and WBEZ Morning Edition anchor Claire Lane. We started with the rumor that Border Patrol should be leaving Chicago soon. Dan cleared things up.
Yeah, so I mean, you may remember that yesterday we woke up to reports from the Tribune and CBS Chicago saying that, hey, these federal agents that have been here for a couple months with Operation Midway Blitz may be leaving.
And for the folks who think I was being serious, it was pure sarcasm.
So our Sun-Times Federal Courts reporter, John Seidel, has had a chance to check in with his law enforcement sources on this, talking to several people behind the scenes with knowledge of what's going on. It does appear that Bovino himself, this is Greg Bovino, commander at large of the Border Patrol, as well as many, many federal agents, will be leaving Chicago possibly as early as next week. There's a lot of speculation over, okay, we've got our first snowstorm. They're taking a picture at the Bean. Right. Are they out of town? It seems like they will be leaving. Of course, on the other hand, the Department of Homeland Security, the spokesperson, is saying, hey, we're not leaving. So there's a little bit of confusion there. But what John is hearing is that, you know, we currently have about 250 agents in Chicago that could be scaled back significantly for now. But there is this thought that coming in the future, in the spring, we could see what they're calling a fourfold of what we're seeing now. So maybe as many as 1,000 agents.
Wow.
So that's a little frightening.
Even more than, I can't even imagine what the streets will look like in March.
And Operation Midway Blitz, it's now been going on for 56 days. John described this as 8 weeks of chaos and fear, which I think is pretty accurate when you talk to people that have been affected, that have been arrested or affected in their neighborhoods.
Yeah, lots of those folks affected include folks in Little Village, right?
Yeah.
That's a community that's been targeted intentionally, safe to say, and they've got lots of recent instances of enforcement happening right there in the neighborhood. I know the governor was there yesterday too, Dan. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, the governor headed out there in part because Greg Bovino said that yesterday there would be a strong immigration arrests, raids, enforcement there. And the governor headed out to support religious leaders and community organizations there. He said a few things, including, quote, "I would not say that we're now going to be free of these terrorized neighborhoods," speaking to the fact that, you know, he had heard that maybe the agents are going away. He also said, "We'll continue to protect our neighbors and our friends and our families." And then he did have some even more colorful language that he used. And let's play a little bit of that.
Whether it was the loss in the elections a week ago that's led to Donald Trump deciding to pull CBP out, or the fact that Greg Bovino is a snowflake on a day when you can see some snowflakes. Whatever it is, the people of Chicago have deserved better than having CBP and Greg Bovino in this city.
So governor coming out hard at Bovino as usual.
That. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Well, let's move over now, Claire, to Palatine in the northwest suburbs. There's a disagreement there over whether a police officer actually helped federal agents during an October arrest. What happened?
Right. So body cam video has been released of this incident showing a Palatine police officer aiding potentially federal agents. This was back in early October. So what happened was the officer can be seen telling a crowd sort of to back up, trying to crowd control, which local enforcement is allowed to do, mm-hmm. but then he's kneeling down in the video to secure the hand of a man who agents were in the process of arresting. So the physical part of that is what is under contention. Under the Illinois Trust Act, local law enforcement officers are prohibited from assisting federal agents in civil immigration enforcement operations, like holding down someone's hand, helping to arrest someone, right? Mm-hmm. But the law does not prevent local law enforcement from, again, what we're talking about, maintaining order, crowd control, keeping the peace, things of that nature. So we've seen this, you know, being expressed by local leaders, Mayor Brandon Johnson, you know, emphasizing that CPD is there to keep the peace,
right,
but not to interfere physically in some of these situations. Village officials in Palestine say the officer was attempting to stabilize the situation. So again, more sort of wordplay right. there. But the Tribune is reporting that the officer's body camera footage does not appear to show people interfering in that arrest. Yeah. So more to come on that from Palatine.
Well, on Veterans Day yesterday, we had thousands of vets taking a stand, right? They were standing up to what they call, you know, just abuses from ICE and Border Patrol, as well as cuts to medical services.
Yeah, more than 300 people here in Chicago, many who have served in the armed forces, participated in a rally. This was held at the Vietnam War Memorial downtown. They were there again to speak out against this aggressive enforcement action taken by ICE and Border Patrol that we've been discussing. Previous member of the Illinois National Guard told WBEZ that she was outraged, very emotional about the Trump administration's actions. Mm-hmm. Others, you know, sort of decried these cuts to medical services at the VA, which we've been seeing a ton of, holding signs and banners, you know, reading no cuts, no ICE. Mm-hmm. Rally goers, you know, then they marched around downtown, ending at City Hall. So again, we're seeing people take to the streets to express how they feel about what's going on.
And right before all that rallying on In the Loop yesterday morning, we talked with a couple of veterans and we discussed why they're protesting this immigration enforcement. I want to play a little bit from Army vet Artie Walker-Petticola.
Right now we have people literally starving because of the cuts to SNAP benefits. And we are instead spending, this administration is instead spending millions and millions of dollars of occupying our cities with National Guard and ICE.
It's a very valid point, Artie. Now, the National Guard, of course, not currently deployed here in Chicago. The Supreme Court ruling could come as early as next Monday, so we're watching for that here on WBEZ. And we'll find out whether or not Trump can actually send troops here. For more of that conversation that you just heard, where I talked with veterans, head over to wbez.org/intheloop. Super powerful conversation. Check out the In the Loop podcast as well. This government shutdown's been going on for 43 days. Can you believe it?
Wow. I mean, that is such a long time.
A long time. I honestly thought that this was going to wrap up in about a week or two.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, at this point, we're over a week past the longest shutdown of all time. That happened during President Trump's first term. I mean, if you think about this, all started on October 1st. At this point, as a parent, Halloween even feels a long time ago, and that was 1 month into the shutdown.
That's right.
So what I've been kind of thinking a lot about in the last few days is the federal workers and what they're going through. Mm-hmm. There's a federal worker that I chat with at the school, you know, at pickup, and he works at a department here in Chicago.
Wow.
He has been without pay for the full shutdown. Some people have gotten partial pay, or you know, pay has stopped at certain.
He hasn't gotten.
He has
anything.
Not gotten any pay. Wow. On Veterans Day yesterday, he was furloughed for 1 day because that's a federal holiday,
mm-hmm.
And it's just he's just. Waiting. I said, do you get any other information that the public doesn't get? And he says, no, I feel like we get less. So it is really challenging for those federal workers. And,
goodness.
You know, this is also at a department that saw a lot of cuts from the Department of Government Efficiency when Elon Musk was in there. So it's just been a lot of turmoil at some of these federal departments during the shutdown.
I've been hearing so much talk about air traffic controllers. Of course, Trump telling them to get back to work and all that. What is the latest on air traffic controllers and airports?
Yeah, so Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy was at O'Hare yesterday, and he said that the FAA flight reductions will continue for a period of time. The House is expected to vote today, most likely, on whether to end the shutdown. It seems like with the way that, you know, Republicans have more seats in the House, it will likely pass. We'll probably get the end of the shutdown, but that doesn't mean that the cancellations will end. I was just kind of checking before we came on air. It seemed like there was over 100 cancellations at O'Hare and Midway already today.
Oh, really?
Now, it is only somewhere between 4% and 10% of overall flights, so it may sound like a high number, but it's a small percentage. So we
would see the difference, maybe, but it's not. We're not seeing crowds and crowds of people just
Yeah, no, I don't think you're seeing crowds and crowds of people. But Duffy is saying that we could see an increase in cancellations even by the end of this week.
Okay.
Even if the shutdown were to end today.
Yeah. Of course, Claire, SNAP benefits, we keep talking about it. This is another one of those impacts. And small grocery stores and convenience store owners, they're speaking out about what's going on.
Yeah, people don't have money for food, so they're not shopping, right? And as we've been discussing, people shopping at grocery stores is good for the economy. And SNAP is a big part of that, especially for small grocers, small convenience stores. Matter of fact, U.S. Department of Agriculture says about 14% of SNAP benefits went to smaller stores that are more accessible to SNAP beneficiaries. So we talked with WBEZ, spoke with Liz Abuna, the owner and operator of 40 Acres Fresh Market. She's been a friend to WBEZ. And so she saw a customer this week putting a full cart of groceries back because she couldn't afford them without her SNAP.
Yeah, I can believe that.
So the Supreme Court has extended an order blocking full SNAP amid signals that the government shutdown, as Dan mentioned, could end today. So we'll see what happens with the vote in the House.
Dan, the latest on the impact of rising Affordable Care Act subsidies, because that's something that we've been talking about here at BEZ and the Sun-Times.
Yeah, and it's at the heart of this whole government shutdown. So unless Congress acts, Affordable Care Act subsidies are expected to rise very, very sharply in Illinois and across the nation on January 1st. Illinois residents could be expected to pay 78% more for insurance without the enhanced credits.
Jeez.
That's according to Get Covered Illinois. And this would affect almost 500,000 Illinois residents. So that's quite a few people. We have a story at WBEZ.org and suntimes.com right now with Elvia Malagon and Summer Van Benton doing some great reporting on a couple of families, exactly what this would mean for them. So this is a big story.
And we'll learn about that in the next hour. Stay tuned for Say More with Mary Dixon and Patrick Smith. Elvia is going to be on that program. She'll talk details of her story. We'll also take your calls about healthcare premiums because, of course, as Dan said, they are going up across the board, not just for people who are on these Obamacare plans. Now, Claire, the holidays are coming, but I hear the Deerfield-based Walgreens gave their workers bad news.
Yeah, more cuts, this time in the form of paid vacation for holidays. So Walgreens is no longer giving many of its retail workers a paid vacation for Thanksgiving, also for Christmas. Bloomberg News is reporting that the pharmacy chain has cut six paid holidays for their hourly store workers. One worker told Bloomberg that she could lose more than $1,000 that she normally gets in wages throughout the year because of the change. As we know, Walgreens stock prices have plummeted more than 85%. They were acquired by a private equity firm in August, and they've made cuts, continue to make cuts, including 80 corporate positions since then. And we're seeing this now being played out in labor in the stores and retail positions.
Yeah. Well, Dan, a lot of great programming here on In the Loop. We're trying to follow the bouncing ball here and keep up with all of these actions. Tell us what we can expect for next week.
Yeah, so you can expect a lot of mayors on the show next week. On Wednesday, we're going to be talking with Evanston Mayor Daniel Biss, as well as Hammond, Indiana Mayor Tom McDermott Jr., and Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle. The three of them are coming in. They're going to tell us, what are they doing to counter ICE, Border Patrol? How has the government shutdown been affecting people in their area? Of course, Cook County has 5.2 million residents and includes the full city of Chicago. And we wanted to also check in with Evanston and Hammond, Indiana, to give a little bit of a sense of what's going on across the region.
That's a great idea.
And then Ask the Mayor with Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson will be next Friday.
He's
on the 21st.
Back.
He'll be back. He comes in every month, answers a lot of listener questions and your questions as well. So we're excited to have him back to see really what's going on with budget negotiations in Chicago. You know, he, proposed his budget last month, and we've got a lot of plans for a corporate head tax and other things.
A lot of follow-up from that budget, too.
What is the latest? There's hearings that are going on now, and they have to pass that budget by the end of the year.
Absolutely. So get ready to call and ask your questions to Mayor Johnson next week, folks. WEZ's Claire Lane and Daniel Tucker.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Sienna Greaves, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.
Right.
Rise and Shy, WBEZ is serving local stories for breakfast every weekday morning from 5 to 11. Tune in on the WBEZ app to hear what Chicago's talking about as you start your day.